Welcome to Puentes a la Comunidad, Bridges to the Community. Hello, I'm your host, Emily Guerra. My guest on this edition is curator for the Remembering the Braceros exhibit at the Brannigan Cultural Center, being held now through October. Thank you for joining me on Puentes.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
What was the Bracero program, and why were these workers called Braceros?
Well, in early August of 1942, the United States and the Republic of Mexico, the governments entered into an agreement to bring laborers from Mexico into the United States to help with the harvest. And at that time, we were at war with Japan, so that all the farm boys and men had been taken into the service, into the armed forces.
In Spanish, an arm is called a brazo, so that would be, a bracero would be a laborer, a worker?
Yes, it's a person that works with his hands, with his arms. Specifically agricultural work in harvesting crops, and that was the term that was applied to them at that time.
What was your first knowledge of the Bracero program?
Well, when I was about 11, 12 years old, maybe even 10, I lived in Deming, and periodically would watch the big trucks with a lot of the Braceros in the back of them, and they would descend on Deming. They would go to all the stores and all the businesses, restaurants, grocery stores, department stores. The stores would close. They'd let them go in there and buy all the merchandise and whatever, and they would cater to them. And they would buy just mounds of clothes and just huge bags of groceries. And they would also go to the theater. There was a theater called the Luna Theater that showed Mexican films in there, which was very, very exciting because they would sing along with the songs sung by people like Pedro Infante, Jorge Negrete, and they knew all the lyrics. So sometimes it was more fun watching them or listening to them sing than it was watching the film itself.
And did you know why they were there? Did your parents explain it to you?
Not at that time. I didn't really know until when I turned 12. I was living in Hachita at the time in southern Grant County when a rancher asked me to go work for him in translating his instructions to about four or five workers that he had there. And it varied, four, three, five. And he would write down the instructions and take off to go do some other business, and I would translate those instructions to the workers themselves. And that included building fences, repairing windmills, rebuilding corrals, and stringing barbed wire fence across the countryside, those kind of things.
So you were his translator, and did you also work on the fields with the workers, with the braceros?
No, not really. I drove a pickup. I didn't have a driver's license at the time. I would drive them to the places of work, and I would haul the supplies, barbed wire, shovels, picks, that kind of stuff to them so that they could accomplish their jobs, lumber.
About how many workers were there working throughout New Mexico and the Southwest?
In New Mexico alone, they varied from 14,000 to 16,000. In Luna County itself, it was averaged about 1,600, so about 10% of the total. It was in Luna County. The vast majority was in Doñana County.
What type of work were they doing?
It varied. In Luna County, it was, for the most part, it was picking cotton. And also working on the railroad. They replaced a lot of railroad workers that had been drafted into the armed forces. In Doñana County, they did the same thing. They harvested crops, whatever the crop was that they had planted. And also they worked in the dairies. Quite a few of them worked in the dairies. And so in working on those farms, they did other work too, like building houses, building doors, framing houses, and those kind of things as a part of their overall work.
And how long would they stay at a job?
They had to sign a contract in order to get involved in the program, and the contract lasted anywhere from 6 to 8 months, sometimes a little longer.
And they were able to come in without documents, or they had working documents?
No. The way it was is that they would be recruited in Mexico, and they would be assembled in collection points like El Paso and Juarez, and they would be screened there, and then they would be stripped down naked, and they would be fumigated. They'd be documented. They would give their IDs and so forth. They'd be fingerprinted. They're brought across. Much of that occurred in El Paso on the United States side. And then once they were there, then they would meet with the growers who offered them contracts, and the growers would go out there and choose 15, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people. And then he or she would bus those or transport those people to the various sites. And they had dormitories for them throughout the Southwest and other places. Something like 34 states had braceros in significant numbers throughout the United States, including places like Michigan and New York. In New York particularly, they worked on the railroad.
What other states were involved in the bracero program?
Well, there were states, particularly in the northern tier, such as Washington, Oregon, North and South Dakota, Michigan, Minnesota. And if you can imagine somebody from the interior of Mexico going up there and working, they have to get acclimated to the cold. And they're well taken care of mostly by the farmers and the growers. But at the same time, they weren't used to the food because who knows what they're eating, because they didn't recognize any of the food at all. They were used to, the beans, the tortillas and chili and as a spice. And so they eventually had to get cooks to go up there and keep their morale up. But it's just one of those things where nobody realizes that it's like us being taken to, say, to Mongolia and being given bread with yak butter and having no idea what it is.
Well, it was during the 40s, during World War II, and the American men weren't here to work on the farms.
Well, part of the impetus to negotiate an agreement with Mexico was the fact that we had just declared war on Japan. And so they were assembling people for the Selective Service Act to fill in the ranks of the armed forces. And the growers knew that they had to do something to harvest the crops, to harvest the cotton, and to harvest the food that was needed. And the only way they could do that quickly and efficiently was to bring in laborers. That first year, there was something like about 12 to 14,000. But then years and years after that, after they became accustomed, it went up to about 300,000 to 400,000 per year.
Were some of these workers able then to get their papers to become citizens?
Well, the vast majority of them returned to Mexico once their contracts had been completed. But a few did, generally at the request of the employers, would go ahead and fill out the necessary documents and applications for permanent residency. And some of them then were processed in for citizenship. In a case here in Hatch, the farmer there valued his employee so much that he helped him get permanent residency and later on a citizenship, and then also helped him bring his family across from Mexico to the U.S. One of the things that this particular family did was whenever the mom would be having a baby, then the farmer's wife would gather up her children and take them to her house and watch over them until the mother came back from the hospital. So there are many, many, many success stories, and obviously, since a lot of them were young men, they came over here and they were single, unmarried, and they noticed a lot of very, very attractive young ladies, and particularly in southern New Mexico.
And so then they married and became citizens.
Yes.
And were able to continue working. Now here in Doña Ana County, in the pecan farms, I understand that one of the largest pecan farmers of the Stallman farms helped their workers by even supplying them with their homes or helping them get loans for their homes and even scholarships for their children.
Yes, the common thread that I found out in talking to former braceros and to their families and their representatives was the fact that here in New Mexico, particularly in New Mexico and particularly in southwest New Mexico, Doña Ana County and Sierra County and Luna County, was that they were treated better here and respected as valued workers than almost anywhere else in the country. Some of the conditions they worked in other places, California, Arizona, were just absolutely horrible, living in cardboard boxes and having no running water, no facilities, and expected to work 14 hours using a very short-handled hoe, which has since then been outlawed by the California Supreme Court. So those kind of things were part of the experience that they had.
So the exhibit that is going on right now at the Brannigan Cultural Center, what can one see? What's the impact that one gets by going through it?
Well, there's a number of statues sculpted by Diane Lemarbe, a very, very talented sculptor. And they represent individual braceros working, either mending fences or framing doors or using a hoe to harvest crops and to weigh the cotton. Part of the problem is that in cotton picking is having these bags and then having to pick the cotton and stuffing the cotton into the bags and having enough cotton in there to meet the quota, because they had a quota for each person for each bag before they could take it to the gin.
So is it more than sculptures? Are there paintings as well?
There are paintings as well by Jerry DeRoche. Very, very beautiful paintings depicting some of the scenes that the braceros were working, in particular working out in the fields. And simply, it's a description of the stoop labor and bending over and picking the crops and doing that bent over for 12 to 14 hours a day.
Why is this important for us to know about it now? I mean, the Bracero program, when did it end?
It ended in 1964.
So this is over 50 years ago. And why is it important for us to continue to know about it?
Well, one of the things that particularly my partner, Diana Lamar, found out that she was completely unaware of it. And in talking to some friends and local historians in Deming, she said, how come I don't read about this stuff in the history books? There are many, many situations where history has just simply ignored them, said nothing about them. And you're going to find that throughout the history of the United States and actually the world, that there are various groups of people that contributed to civilization that just there's no record of them and or very little record of them. And I imagine that as time goes on, people that experienced those times will go ahead and have their children talk about it. I kind of liken it to the situation with World War II. There was a lot of publicity about that, and you know they call it the greatest generation for the United States. And at the same time, we have the Korean War, which is not very popular at the time, and then, of course, followed by the Vietnamese War in Vietnam, and even less. So I think that as time goes on, those particular issues will come to the fore because people are going to talk about them more and more and more. And the same thing with the braceros is that people, as they become enlightened and more educated, will understand what a big contribution they made so that the United States could prevail in World War II.
Well, you're going to be talking about it more and more as well on July the 6th at the Brannigan Cultural Center during the Ramble. And there'll be men dressed as braceros?
Yes, we have actors that are going to reenact some of the activities that the braceros engaged in, you know, harvesting crops and that sort of things, riding in vehicles and so forth. As part of the presentation, it's going to be accompanied by music. I'd call it period music from the 40s and 50s. It's going to be provided by the Music Alegre Band and the Bracero Activity Actors. And then, of course, the statues have been sculpted by Diana Lamar.
And you'll be narrating what the program is about. And what was your passion to learn more about the Bracero program?
It was a personal involvement. One of the things that I did for them was I wrote letters for them. And I would read the letters that they received. And some of them were, you know, traditional husband to wife or family to son. But other things were pretty sad. Family members passing away back in Mexico, and they had no way to get back there to them. And generally going back there and finding out that a family member, cherished family member, had died and was already buried by the time they got there. And those kind of things. Things that to us, we take for granted that, you know, that somebody passes away and then we have several days in which to get ready to go to a funeral. In Mexico, even to this day, it's very, very difficult because they generally will end up interring the body generally almost overnight within a couple of days. And so that gives either far-flung families who have a hard time getting there.
Well, we expect to have quite a few visitors at the Brannigan Cultural Center, especially during the Ramble on July the 6th. Raymond Cobos, thank you for joining me on Puentes.
I enjoyed being here. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. For KRWG, I'm Emily Guerra.